on 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty. Game on, weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Yes, a big thank you to the two Johnnies for keeping us entertained this afternoon. It's Tuesday the 15th of March. I'm Shane Dawson and you're listening to Game On. Coming up over the next hour, we'll be crossing live to Rilby Walsh at a noisy, very, very noisy Prestbury Park as day one of the Cheltenham Festival winds down with the record-breaking Rachel Blackmore stealing the headlines on Honeysuckle.
And this is the final for the hurdles. Honeysuckle over. Everton paddles through it. Then Zana here in third. And it is Honeysuckle once again up on the Cheltenham Hill and bounding away. Another champion hurdle for Honeysuckle remains unbeaten. Rachel Blackmore and Henry de Bromhead, the first pair to win two champion hurdles.
I'll also be chatting to Greg Allen, who will have all the latest from the world of golf as Henrik Stenson is revealed as Team Europe's Ryder Cup captain, and we'll have plenty of association football chat in the company of Mark Langdon and Paul Corry as we review last night's League of Ireland and build up to tonight's Champions League matches.
Fred turning it round to Ronaldo.
And if that wasn't enough, well, I'll also be chatting to Ireland international Áine O'Gorman. So plenty to look forward to over the next hour. As always, if you want to get in touch, drop us a text on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Yes, it is great to have your company on Game On this Tuesday evening, wherever you are tuning in from.
Game On.
Racing.
Well, there is only one place to begin this evening, and that is looking back on day one of the Cheltenham Festival. And there's only one headline, one topic to begin with, Ruby Walsh. A perfect 15 for Honeysuckle. Rachel Blackmore handled the heavy favourites tag to win the champion hurdle. And record-breaking performance by, I think at this stage we're just running out of superlatives to describe this duo.
I think we are too, Shane. I mean, Honeysuckle's a wonderful mare, but they are an incredible pair, herself and Honeysuckle. Rachel Blackmore and Honeysuckle, that is. And I must say, I thought Honeysuckle was brilliant, but I thought Rachel was magic on her this afternoon as well. I mean, all the pressure was on her. 70-odd thousand people here, eyes glued to her. There was expectation as well as the pressure to perform. But she rode her really bravely. She rode her to win the race. She didn't ride her not to lose. And, you know, she didn't play it safe. She was brave. Top of the hill, she went inside, not so sleepy. Got outside, appreciated at the third last hurdle and went between appreciated in Zana here. She took chances on her. She was brave on her. Like 70-odd thousand people here. Huge expectation, huge pressure. And she was brave on her. She rode her to win. She didn't ride her just not to lose. And, you know, she went inside at the top of the hill, inside not so sleepy, went outside appreciated, went for the gap between Zana here and appreciated down to the second last hurdle. And Honeysuckle delivered everywhere, and they got an unbelievable reception, which they really deserved because they did it here last year and there was no one here to cheer them on. So it was great to see them get the adulation that they deserved.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know you spent most of your day on analysis duty in a TV truck, but how great was it having the fans, and could you hear that roar when they crossed the line? Because you mentioned how the reception she got. I mean, just watching on from TV at home myself, like, it was deafening. It was brilliant and well deserved.
Ah, it was. I mean, it was incredible. And look, we had some great performances here as well today, Shane. I mean, look, from an Irish point of view, I don't think too many Irish people thought that England or Great Britain would have more winners on the opening day than Ireland did. The score ended up 4-3 on the day. But look, Constitution Hill was amazing in the first race for Nico de Bonville and Nicky Henderson. Like, the performance he put up, and even on the clock, was quite incredible. And that kind of set the tone off. It got the English, gave the English something to cheer about, Shane. And they didn't have much, even if they were at home, to cheer about last year. Then Edward Stone won the second for Tom Cannon and Alan King, which, and it was a really good performance. And, you know, the Irish kind of were looking for Honeysuckle when she appeared, and they needed Honeysuckle to win, and she delivered, and that probably made that reception all the better.
Yeah, no, listen, there's so many positives to take as well, but, and you mentioned there a few of the big winners of it today already. Anything else catch your eye, I suppose? If I know it's myself presenting this evening, not Marie Crowe, but I'd say she was happy to see Marie's Rock holding off the pack to give Nicky Henderson his second win at the festival.
actually sent me a WhatsApp. She sent me a WhatsApp, Shane, giving out that we'd done a preview and we hadn't mentioned a horse called Marie's Rock. Marie's Rock was an 18-month in the one shot. Now, if Marie wants to pick horses purely on their names rather than on form, she could well have mentioned Marie's Rock herself, but I didn't see it coming. I don't think too many people in Shelton saw it coming either. But she was a good winner of that. Off Queen's Brook of Gordon Elliott's, and then in the final race for the top of the hill, it was Gordon Elliott versus Willie Mullins, Patrick Mullins versus Jamie Codd, and Patrick came out on top on Statler. Tomorrow night they'll probably go again, Patrick v Jamie in the bumper, Fast Salviga versus American Mike. And you know, we've only one day down, we still have 3 days to look forward to, but yeah, a day here for the Irish this afternoon. And Pádraig Roach is a brilliant winner as well in the Bootles Fred Winter Hurdle, when Brazil just got the better of the plunge horse Gaelic Warrior of Willie Mullins's.
Yeah, a bit of a shock in the handicap hurdle there as well. I was looking forward to tomorrow. And just on that point about Marie mentioning Marie's Rock, I say there's a lot of punters as well just picking horses by the name, particularly in this Cheltenham Festival as well, Ruby. But looking ahead at tomorrow, the feature race then being the Grade 1 Champion Chase, which has run over 2 miles and has been won by some legendary horses down the years. There's a stacked card throughout tomorrow, to be fair, with four Grade 1 races in total, including the Novices Chase and the Ballymore Novices Hurdle as well. So I suppose a very loaded question for you, Ruby, to distill, but there's just so much to look forward to.
There is. It's a wonderful card again afternoon. Obviously, Shishkin in the Champion Chase is the highlight. Enogramine and Shaq and Pourceau will be taking him on. But look, the ground is good here, Shane, and that will definitely suit the English horses. Shishkin, I think he's a superstar anyway, and he'd be hard to beat, so I think he'll win the big one. In the first race, which is the Ballymore Properties Novices Hurdle, I think the favourite will win, Sir Gerhard of William Mullins's. I think he's a very good horse. He didn't run in the Supreme. He waited for the Ballymore. I think he's his day in the sun tomorrow afternoon. The second is the Brown Advisory Novice Chase. Very competitive. Brave Man's Paul Nichols, a high senior for Lucinda Russell, home for Venetia Williams, and Capitano for Willie. That's a really good race. I actually think Long Presse for Venetia and Charlie Deutsch stepping up in trip, he could be the one to follow there. And of course, you have the bumper, and that'll be fascinating. Fasa Viga versus American Mike, James's Gate, and Gentleman's Gate, or Brave Man's Gate, Gentleman's Game, sorry, as well. And of course, we can't Tiger on. He praying, or Gordon, Michael O'Leary even, will be hoping for Marion's ground stays away the way it is right now. He's favoured good ground and couldn't go out in a blaze of glory.
Yeah, absolutely. Ruby, you'd usually be joining me for the hour, but as our listeners know, you're over enjoying yourself in Cheltenham and working very hard as well. But my final question, if we go from horse racing to football, because we'll be having a bit of a football chat later, I'm going to have to throw a Man United question at you this evening, Ruby. Can they do it? Will they be getting through to the next round of the Champions League?
No. won't be. And turn out their misery tonight and move on. Think about next year.
Predictable and concise. Ruby Walsh, listen, you've had a long, long, busy day, hopefully an enjoyable day. And I was going to say I'll check in with you, but Marie Crowe will be back tomorrow evening. So we'll be checking in with you then on day two of the Cheltenham Festival. Ruby Walsh, thank you very much. Enjoy yourself.
RTE
2FM.
Game on
2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on.
Football.
Hello, once again, you're very welcome back to Game on this Tuesday evening. It is great to have your company. You heard just before the break, Ruby Walsh wasn't giving Manchester United much of a chance ahead of their Champions League tie this evening. Well, it's time to get the thoughts of the Racing Post's Mark Langdon and former professional footballer Paul Corry as we turn our attention to tonight's Champions League. Mark, if I come to you first, United interim boss Ralph Rangnick has called for his players and the club's fans to be on top form for his side's Champions League game against Atletico Madrid. The tie is evenly poised after a one-all draw with the La Liga champions in Spain last month. Rangnick said all players were available for the last 16 second-leg tie, but there was a small question mark over the fitness of Luke Shaw, who recently tested positive for coronavirus. Midfielder Bruno Fernandes is back in training after returning a negative COVID test, while fellow midfielder Scott McTominay also trained on Monday, having missed United's last game against Tottenham on Saturday with a half injury. Manchester United have only won 3 of their last 9 games in all competitions, 5 draws and 1 loss. I suppose the simple question to you, Mark, is can Manchester United get the job done tonight?
They can, yeah, of course they can. I think for all that bad form that Manchester United are in, the fact that, you know, they didn't play very well, even though they won on Saturday against Tottenham, and I still think that they're slightly scarred by what happened the week before from that Manchester derby, a chastening defeat at the hands of Manchester City. Atletico Madrid are not the Atletico Madrid of last season, or even sort of, you know, the years when they were reaching the Champions League final. I think we saw that in the first leg. They started very well, but once United sort of got the game under control more in the second half, they were able to match Atletico, and that was in a very difficult environment away from home at the Wanda Metropolitano. So, I, you know, from what we've seen of Atletico this season, I think that Manchester United have got a very fair chance of qualifying. I suppose if you were sort of, you know, on a Spanish radio station asking kind of an English football expert, they'd be saying probably the same thing about Manchester United, because they're not playing well. So it's about really, I think, who turns up. And in situations like this, it's very few people better to have sort of in the ranks, really, rather than Cristiano Ronaldo. I think Atletico, probably man for man, are sort of slightly better than United, but with the Old Trafford factor, I think it's going to be a very close game. And, you know, the away goal rule not in operation anymore, wouldn't surprise me if we went to extra time and maybe even to penalties. I think it's a really tight tie.
There's obviously been a lot of reliance, some might say over-reliance, on Cristiano Ronaldo, who you mentioned there. 37 years of age now, he bagged a hat-trick at the weekend. Would you have any fear, Mark, over just his fitness, playing two games in the space of four days?
No, I wouldn't. I think the fear of his fitness comes more in the fact of when United haven't got the ball, you know, how do they press opponents? And I think that can be a really difficult situation for any manager. And we saw Rangnick, I don't know if Ronaldo was injured or whether he didn't want him to play against Manchester City. He wasn't available in the end for that game, but he wasn't going to play even when he was fit. And I think if you haven't got the ball, then Ronaldo gives you a big problem, because at his age, he can't press. I don't think he enjoyed that side of the game even when he was younger. Atletico Madrid are not the type of team that's going to come to Old Trafford and dominate possession. And you know, I don't really see a reason for United to go hunting the ball necessarily off of them. So I think that suits Ronaldo. He'll definitely have the fitness to be able to play the game. I think it's more tactically in terms of the really big games as to whether you can carry Ronaldo when you haven't got possession. But from a fitness point of view, I'd say he'd be as fit as most of those players in the United team.
So continuing the conversation on Manchester United's forward play and their attackers, Paul Carey, if I was to throw a few stats at you. So it seems that Atletico Madrid can be got at, because they've only kept 3 clean sheets in the last 15 league matches. They've conceded 2 or more goals in 8 of those games. It's 36 goals conceded now already in this season's La Liga. They only let in 25 in the whole of last season. So if Cristiano Ronaldo is on form like he was last weekend, and if Marcus Rashford now can silence some of his doubters, and we've seen what Anthony Elanga can do, even if he sprung from the bench, I mean, United can really get at Atletico.
Yeah, they can, and I think that probably goes back to Mark Lang's point about, you know, they're probably not the same beast as they were previously, whereas Atletico were so efficient about keeping oppositions out, and, you know, they prided themselves on clean sheets. That probably frailty in the back four, back five, whichever they go with, has certainly been there over the last number of months, and that probably goes to, yes, losing personnel, but maybe some other defenders maybe pushing on a bit in age. And I think when Anthony Elanga came on in the first leg, I should say, he actually changed the dynamic of the game. Those types of teams, particularly the Spanish ones, they tend to suffer or struggle with a bit of pace, and Elanga certainly offered that to them in that second half, and he certainly changed the dynamic of how things worked out. I think when you're looking at Manchester United, you probably can't afford to have the performances that they had in the first leg. Like, Rashford was really poor that night. Fernandes kept coughing up the ball. Remember Varane coming out from the back once or twice and just conceding possession at that level. You just can't afford to do that, Shane. I think what's probably going to be a really important factor is who scores the first goal. tonight, because albeit Atletico have shown maybe a bit of defensive frailty, if you nip yourself in front, whether it be in the first half or the second half, you know you've just got to see out whatever's left on the clock. And Simeone and the way his team operate, they can be a very difficult beast to shut down if they are to nip themselves in front. So whoever gets that first goal in this game, whether it is to come, could prove, you know, pivotal in regards to how this tie actually pans out.
So the first goal could be crucial. And Mark, I suppose if Atletico aren't the beast that they were, they seem to have turned a bit of a corner lately. What should we expect from Diego Simeone and from Atletico Madrid this evening in terms of putting up a challenge to Manchester United?
Well, I think you'll see as many dark arts as is possible to get away with, and sometimes they will stray on across that. And so I think discipline, absolutely vital. You know, Atletico will be trying to tempt players into getting yellow cards. They will be at the referee virtually every minute. I think the real sort of danger comes from João Felix when he is playing well. Usually sort of he plays up front, but he plays sort of, he can either play in the space just off the forward, or he likes to maybe sort of drift out to his left and that United right. And I think he sort of showed in the first leg, particularly in the first half, he ran out of steam a bit in the second half. Just his, you know, overall quality is there, and I would love to see him play for more of a footballing team. Like, you could see him if he was a Manchester City or a team that really sort of likes to dominate possession. I think he would stand out. It's not like that at Atletico. Simeone likes his forwards to do a lot of work off the ball, and it's not always the prettiest of football. I think in terms of sort of hurting United, I think João Felix is the main man. One of the players that's been really out of form, and mentioning there the stats on Atletico and the amount of goals they've conceded, Jan Oblak, without question one of the world's best goalkeepers, has had, by his standards, an absolutely shocking season. He's been really, really awful. And I'm not talking about sort of glaring errors, but he's just not making very many saves. And even that one in the first leg a couple of weeks ago, I felt like he really overcompensated on his near post that allowed the equaliser. You know, 12 months ago, if you'd said to me, who's the best goalkeeper in the world, I would have said Jan Oblak. Not, you know, with the ball at his feet, Neuer, Alisson, Edison, those are much better. But pure goalkeeping, sort of old-fashioned stuff, Oblak was the best around. He, whether it's a lack of confidence, lack of form, I'm not quite sure. But if I were Manchester United, I'm sure Cristiano Ronaldo won't need asking twice. I'll be taking a lot of shots at him just to sort of test him, because this is not the Jan Oblak. If it's not the Atletico Madrid of 2 years ago, it's definitely not the Jan Oblak of 2 years ago.
Yeah, some headaches for Diego Simeone with the goalkeeping situation, but also in terms of the players he can choose. Yannick Carrasco will miss out through suspension. Mateus Cunha, Daniel Vaz, Simeone Vrsaljko and Thomas Lemar remain sidelined through injury. Koke may return. He returned at the weekend from a muscle injury, played 45 minutes in Atletico's win over Cadiz, and could start. Mario Hermoso, Jeffrey Condogbia and Jose Jimenez are all also travelling in the squad, but are doubts with Knox as well. Paul, Mark mentioned Jan Oblak and going through a bit of a dip in form, to say the least, on terms of Man United's defence, because Mark was touching on kind of João Felix and all the attacking threats that the away side will have this evening. And David De Gea has been in inspired form, and he's been nearly as crucial, if not more crucial, than Cristiano Ronaldo in keeping Manchester United in games, both in Europe and in the league. In defence, and I suppose it just comes back round to this question of who do you feel should start in Man United's defence? And I don't want to be pinpointing Harry Maguire in particular, but if you're talking about Atletico, kind of their forwards digging in, doing the dirty work and having a bit of burst of pace from João Felix and having that kind of bit of intelligence, you'd be worried when you see Harry Maguire coming up and trying to man mark him.
Yeah, you certainly would. And Harry Maguire probably favours playing against a more physical centre forward, somebody who's going to get up and close and personal with them and maybe deal with crosses from wide areas. His game certainly isn't suited to the likes of a João Felix, who's, you know, that low centre of gravity, who's going to, I guess, kind of come in and out of the game and pick up positions in areas that Harry Maguire isn't going to want to go into. So if you're asking me who it suits from a centre-half point of view, you're probably looking at the more agile Raphael Varane and Lindelof to come in and play up against Felix and maybe to track him into those difficult areas. And when you look at Atletico Madrid, you know, whether it's been this season or in years gone by, they've always maybe played for one or two of their players. You know, the whole team is set up to get the ball to Felix and they play off him and around him. Similarly with Griezmann down through the years, they've always played for those types of players. So when you think back to the first leg, João Felix was electric in that first half and he created them so many problems. And it was a case that they were actually lucky, I thought, Manchester United to get in at halftime, only one goal behind. So they really need to have that solid foundation tonight. Just going back to what I was saying, if Atletico score first, and touching on Mark's point, you could see them slowing the game down, making it difficult for Manchester United to get back into. And that centre-half pairing, who Rangnick goes with, he probably will favour Maguire and Varane. Would I be surprised if he went with Lindelof and Varane to partner just to nullify that Felix threat? I wouldn't be at all surprised. But that weakness has been there all season, Shane. It's not going to disappear tonight because they might change two centre-halves. The organisation between the back four, the midfield and the goalkeeper at times has looked a bit hectic. And it's certainly something that needs to be rectified longer term. It will probably hinder them going far in this competition, and it'll be one that'll be interesting to see how they go on tonight.
From a purely neutral perspective, I'd love to see Joao Felix and Eric Bailly just go up against each other just for the pure carnage of Eric Bailly and what to expect from him. But gentlemen, that's not the only Champions League tie on this evening. Mark, former European champions Ajax and Benfica reconvene in Amsterdam with their round of 16 tie level at 2-2 after a pulsating first leg in Lisbon. And I suppose this is a tie some Man United fans will keep a close eye on as well, considering the manager of Ajax, Erik ten Hag, being heavily linked with the Manchester United job.
Yeah, absolutely. And also the Paris Saint-Germain job. I mean, in the group stage, Ajax were electrifying, one of the best teams in the opening stage, absolutely destroyed Borussia Dortmund and you know, were playing some real eye-catching football, maybe even better than the team that we saw a couple of years ago reach the semi-finals before they were eliminated in those sort of dramatic scenes against Tottenham. And that team had Frenkie de Jong and Matthijs de Ligt, who went on to Barcelona and Juventus respectively. I think collectively this sort of bunch might, like I say, be able to actually be called a better team. They certainly look it in the Eredivisie. But the one weakness they've got is that they are so attacking and they're wide open. And when they were winning 2-1 in that first leg away from home, and they conceded a goal with their centre-back trying to dribble past an opponent inside the sort of Benfica penalty box. Benfica broke and managed to equalise. There's probably not that many teams in Europe when you're 2-1 up away from home in a Champions League knockout tie that would have their centre-backs doing that. But it is their style, it is their philosophy. They're not going to change it. I would expect them at home to be able to get through to the quarterfinals. I just think when we're talking about them potentially going all the way, I do worry about them defensively. You look at sort of the best teams in Europe, and I'm looking at Manchester City and Liverpool, particularly in the holders, Chelsea. They just look much better than Ajax defensively. So Erik ten Hag absolutely deserves to work at a sort of a club that can kind of, you know, give him more financial power in the transfer market and maybe sort of better opportunities to challenge for sort of, you know, European honours. But I think if Manchester United do go for him in the summer, it could be a very sort of competitive field, because, like I said, there are sort of rumours that maybe Paris Saint-Germain, almost certain that they'll get rid of Pochettino, could also be suitors for Erik ten Hag.
And then Pochettino just segues nicely into Manchester there, perhaps. So we'll be interested to see how that one goes. Paul Corry, this is one for the football hipsters, one for the football purists. Ajax Benfica, how do you see this one going?
I thought you were going to say shells and bows there when you said hipsters. I was sure that's where you were going with it.
We'll be moving on to the League of Ireland chat in a few moments' time. So that's a good plug for it as well. So do stay tuned for that.
It absolutely is. Yeah, I probably favour Ajax. I think they've been really impressive any time I've seen them this year. They always get a massive crowd in Amsterdam. And with Sebastian Haller and Tadic in good form, they spurred a couple of good chances in the first leg as well to actually extend that lead out to maybe take them to 3-1. So I'd say even on the balance of the first leg, the number of chances they created, home advantage, you'd expect them to go through.
Okay, well, moving from Champions League, but sticking with an English club, I want to bring up the topic of Chelsea yet again. We talked at length last night about the Chelsea-Newcastle match and I suppose the negative aspects of that. But Mark, if I come to yourself, obviously the news today was Chelsea releasing a statement and requesting that their FA Cup tie with Middlesbrough was played behind closed doors. They stated sporting integrity, which didn't go down too well. Now, the latest is they've withdrawn the request to play behind closed doors. But I suppose it's another negative day for Chelsea PR.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not sure who felt that that was a good idea. You know, there is an argument to be said that maybe the FA could, you know, potentially, why can't Middlesbrough sell the tickets to Chelsea fans? You know, do Chelsea fans deserve to be punished? Should they still be able to watch their team? Yeah, there's a few different arguments there. But I think Chelsea are not in a position at the moment to be doing any bargaining on you know, and trying to get the FA or Premier League, depending on what competition they're in, to sort of bend over, sort of backwards for them. It was a ill-advised statement. I mean, Steve Gibson, the Middlesbrough chairman, was absolutely outraged by it and has come out with some very strong words this afternoon, sort of firing back at Chelsea's sporting integrity. And I think that there'll be a lot of people kind of nodding along with Steve Gibson. You know, it's not a great situation for the fans, the players, the manager and staff at Chelsea, but I think they've just got to suck it up, really, because I don't think it's an undeserved punishment.
Yeah, Chelsea, of course, are in Lille tomorrow evening. They have a two-goal advantage heading into their Champions League tie, and they face a 10-hour round trip now for that Middlesbrough match because Thomas Tuchel has confirmed they won't be flying, they'll be taking the bus as well. And you mentioned Steve Gibson's comments there, Mark. I think he was saying they are fueled by corrupt money, so certainly coming out firing in that one, and will be interesting. But lads, let's finish on a positive note. I want to bring up Christian Eriksen. He's been named in the Denmark squad for this month's international friendlies, 9 months after suffering a cardiac arrest during Euro 2020. Paul, a real, genuine, feel-good story.
Yeah, incredible, Shane. And it's hard to believe that after what happened in the European Championships to think that you could fast-forward time and he'd still be involved in another international appearance and hopefully gearing his way up towards the World Cup, which is coming around very quickly. But, you know, the fact that he's managed to get himself back fit and playing and obviously on advice of doctors, but also then to just get himself back up to a level as well. Like in the games that he's played for Brentford, you can see his class is still there. He's obviously going to be a vital part of what Brentford do between now and the end of the season. I think they've won the last two games. They've picked up in form. And a lot of that, you would have to say, is because of Christian Eriksen. Brentford, the way they play, a lot of it goes through Mbeumo and Tony. And now they've got somebody who can actually feed the two of them in Eriksen. And you've seen that in his displays, his set pieces have been as accurate as ever. And it's just a really good story that's going around, and to see somebody who's had such a tragic incident in his life, and to see him bounce back and to see him at the peak of both domestic football in the UK and international football now is just something that nobody would have foreseen 12, 18 months ago.
Absolutely, it certainly is a good bit of news to finish our European football chat. Mark Langdon, thank you very much for joining us. Paul Currie, you're going to stick around because we're going to be chatting League of Ireland in a few moments' time. And Anya O'Gorman will also be joining the conversation, so do stay tuned.
RTE
2FM.
Game on
2FM with Green Farm. Being up to 90 isn't real. The protein in our range is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on.
Football.
Yes, you're very welcome back to Game On as we are sticking with our association football chat in the company of Paul Currie as we turn our attention to the League of Ireland. Paul, there was a full billing in the League of Ireland last night, and I suppose only one place to start. You mentioned it already, one for the footballing purists, Bohemian Football Club versus Shelburne Football Club in a North Dublin derby. It finished 1-1, and in truth, Shell's unlucky not to come away with all 3 points from Dalymount.
Probably would have suspected, Shane, that once they'd actually gone ahead, it was Sean Boyd off the bench. He scored his first touch within 60 seconds of coming on. You probably would have expected that tougher Shells would have gone on and won that game, particularly considering that Roy Feely got sent off after that goal went in. So, I mean, high level and looking at it, taking a step back, it's another point on the board for Shells, but it's probably two that they'll feel that got away. And you know, Bowes will probably look at that as one gained. Grant Horton with a header towards the end of the game, and he's somebody who's actually come in and looked really impressive. I thought he was excellent in the Dublin Derby last week, which isn't an easy game to play in, and obviously somebody who's coughed up with another goal last night. So somebody for the Bowes faithful that they can look at building their back four around. But for Damien Duff and for Shells, it's probably one that they maybe feel has gotten away from them, and it was a really good chance to put 3 points on the board.
Yeah, and I think it's a good position for a newly promoted club to be frustrated with not coming away with all 3 points from Dalymount, considering how good a squad Bowes have, because that's a point now picked up against Bowes, that's a point picked up against Dundalk as well on the Friday night in Talca Park. So, you know, they're good points for a promotion team to get. I suppose they'd probably be frustrated to only draw with UCD the week previous. But you mentioned Sean Boyd coming on, and I'm not sure if you saw it. There's been clips going around on Twitter and social media for anyone who hasn't seen it. Sean Boyd, yes, did come on and score within 60 seconds, but he also got yellow carded because as Shane Farrell got brought down on the edge of the box or in the box, whichever way you want to have a look at it. Personally speaking, I think it was inside the box. Now, granted, Rob Harvey, I think, had a very good game and he let it flow, particularly in the second half. It was a proper, tasty, good, old-school challenges, proper derby feel to it, and it was a sellout crowd as well, so it was a really great atmosphere. But Sean Boyd actually sprung from the sideline to appeal for the penalty, and he got about 5-8 yards onto the pitch as well before being booked. But I wasn't sure if it was Sean Boyd that got a yellow card or Damien Duff who ended up down the sideline who got a yellow card, considering Duff already got booked against Dundalk as well. And I think Damien was saying that he'll have plenty of learnings, I hate that word and that phrase, but to take, and he'll be growing in his experience managerial career now.
Anybody who knows Sean Boyd, or anybody who's watched Sean Boyd down through his career, knows that Sean Boyd picks up yellow cards. Whether he's involved in the game or he's not, he seems to be a man who always seems to pick up a book, and he was like that when I was at Rovers with him. But it looked a penalty. I mean, I've seen it back on Twitter, Shane, and it certainly looks like the challenge takes place in the box. Now, you have to grant the officials a bit of leeway here, in the sense that the linesman was over the other side. It's not an easy one to pick up. It happened very quickly, and we're talking the distance here, minimal between being inside or outside of the box. So maybe one that you're maybe more likely to get in Talca Park than you are as a travelling side in Dalymount. That's sometimes the nature of how these things go. But you mentioned it there. I think they've picked up some good results, Shells. I think naturally enough, it could be a bit of a mixed bag with regards to performances that they deliver this season, just with the new management and blooding so many new faces together within that squad. Some of the performances are going to be good, some of them are going to be bad, some results are going to be good, and likewise some will be bad. But it's gathering a bit of momentum. I think what's important from Shell's point of view is there's a bit of distance now between themselves, Drogheda, Finn Harps and UCD, and that was always going to be the goal this season.
Yeah, I think that will turn into a bit of a mini table with those teams you mentioned there battling out to stay up. On the other end of the table, Dundalk and Rovers played out an entertaining stalemate. Nathan Shepherd with a great save to keep a clean sheet for Dundalk. But Rovers, another draw, another couple of points dropped.
Yeah, I think Nathan Shepherd is probably the first person that you go to there. Save from Aaron Green towards the end of the game was absolutely superb, point blank. It was one that the header, Aaron Green's headed into the ground, it's bounced up, and he's done really well to claw it away. He had another good save, I think, from Richie Towell earlier in the game. Richie Towell hit the crossbar. So Rovers certainly had good chances, but they certainly could have lost that point late on. Pat Hooban had an excellent chance for Dundalk to nick all 3 points. And to be honest with you, Shane, I think it's a point that both teams would probably be happy enough with. You look at Dundalk and how they've started the season now. It's a strange set of results. They've won one and they've drawn 5 from 6, so they're still unbeaten, but probably want to start converting some of those draws into wins. And I think Steve be relatively happy, though. They've played Sligo, they've played Derry, they've played Shamrock Rovers. Their next two fixtures are UCD and Drogheda. You'd expect them to bank 6 points there, and that will certainly get them motoring up the table. So one where Steve be probably happy not to lose the game. I think Stephen Bradley going away to Dundalk, they're not the same beasts as they were previously, but a point's not a bad result for them. But probably looking at the first 6 games, Shamrock Rovers 10 points, probably suspected that they'd be a little further up the table, and maybe just waiting for things to click, in particular with the likes of Burke, Mandreou, Byrne, Green, still looking for the ingredients there, Stephen Bradley, that's going to get them, I guess, firing in that final third.
Yeah, and moving up to Derry, Jamie McGonigal's double giving the Candy Stripes all 3 points, but an injury to Michael Duffy really taking the headlines there. His return to his hometown club was cut short, so a big blow for Derry there. He's fractured his tibia, so it remains to be seen how long he'll be out for.
Yeah, it doesn't sound good, and it's really, really disappointing because Michael Duffy is somebody who's lit this league up in previous years while he's been at Dundalk, and when he's in full flow, he's one of those players that you love to see. Going back up to Derry, I'm sure he would have been excited going back up to his hometown club. The project under Rory Higgins has really taken off, and he is somebody that you would have looked to have been a pivotal part of that project, and it's really disappointing for him. I'm gutted for him because I'm sure, you know, he was looking forward to playing a big part of it. But for Derry City, I mean, they're picking up results. They've got great momentum. The Brandywell certainly looking like a difficult place to go. And in Jamie McGonigal, they've got somebody who's banging form and scoring goals. So it's going to be really interesting, Shane, to see what it is they can do there. If they could add one or two or three players in that kind of window in the summer, they really wouldn't be far off Shamrock Rovers, because what they've shown in the first couple of games is going to the Brandywell is going to be difficult, and they've certainly got the personnel there, and they've got a manager there who can certainly challenge at least up the top end of the table.
Yeah, they're certainly looking for a bit of consistency. Speaking of managers who are doing well, Liam Buckley unearthing a few talents and making some shrewd signings in the off-season, and Aidan Keane being one of them, scoring a hat-trick in a 3-1 win for Sligo Rovers over Finn Harp. So Bucko seems to be pulling a couple of rabbits out of the hat as always.
Bucko always seems to, and it's probably a club, Sligo, in general terms, that maybe it's because they're so far west that they don't get the plaudits that they deserve. But even if you look at last night's fixture, two players who have been really important for Sligo over the last 12-18 months is Gary Buckley and Greg Bulger, and he managed to rotate the team, give the two lads a rest. They're probably not as fresh as they were maybe 5-10 years ago, and he's managed to rest their legs up, and he's still got a performance out of his side. And you know, Sligo are still unbeaten. They've won 3 from 5. They've got a striker. Like, probably the main concern that people would have had was that when Johnny Kenny left, he was such a promising striker. He contributed a lot last year. Who were they going to bring in? And it seems like Keane has come in and he's hit the ground running. I saw him when they played out in Richmond Park, and he caused all sorts of problems. He's got a number of different facets to the game, so that he can actually take the ball to feet, he can run in behind, and on the basis of the goals that he's scored so far, he looks a real natural in front of goal. So if they can keep him fit, if they can keep the likes of Greg and Buckley fit, they're certainly another team who could go far, because Liam Buckley knows the league so well. He knows how to get a kick out of players, and what they've shown over the last 2 years while he's been up there, that there's been consistent improvements within the side, and on the basis of their start, it certainly looks like they're heading that direction again.
Yeah, that was always a concern, I suppose, when we were doing all the pre-season previews, whether these players could click, but they certainly have. And it's great to see Aidan Keane getting a hat-trick and settling in well, because he's had a few clubs, he's been out on loan, he's travelled around a bit, so hopefully this season does go well for him and indeed Sligo. One striker who is tried and trusted and has been around the block is Owen Doyle. He was on the mark again for Pats as they defeated UCD 2-0. And a great sellout crowd. I think I saw on Twitter that the crowd in Richmond Park was more than the last two or three times Pats and UCD played, the combined crowds for that as well. So it's great to see fans back at the League of Ireland, particularly on a Monday night. Like, as I said, it was sold out in Daly Mount Park as well. Great crowd out in Inchicore as well. An expected victory for Pats, Paul.
100%, and if ever there was a banker, it was Owen Doyle to score against UCD, like an experienced striker who's been around, who knows how to sniff out chances against an inexperienced back four. And he's certainly delivered. That's, I think, 2-2 for Owen Doyle, and Pats have brought him in to score goals. He looked really good in the President's Cup final, and then I thought he took a bit of dip in form, but that's probably understandable enough, getting used to playing with new players, new league, getting up to grips with how Pats are going to approach games. But I mean, he is the type of guy that will kind of drift in and out of games, might not do a lot, and then pop up with two. It's just the nature of his
of his style, and he'll certainly win you games, and he's contributed again last night. And Pat, I was probably a little concerned with Shane, particularly after the Bowes game in Daly Mount and the nature of the goal they conceded. I was worried that they would cough up chances, but they've now gone three games in a row without conceding a goal, and that always gives you a chance in games. And when you can feed the likes of Dara Burns, Mark Doyle and Owen Doyle, who both scored last night, you're always going to have a chance. So Tim Clancy, you got to hand it to him. He's lost a lot of players who were core to what it is they did last year. They obviously lost their manager. There was all sorts of complications in the off-season, but he steadied the ship. He's got some good results and good performances out of that team, and he's blooding the young players that came through last year. So positive signs for Pats. It's going to be interesting to see whether or not Shamrock Rovers can really kick into gear and kind of push towards Pats and beyond Pats, and who's going to be able to go with them. Because if you're looking at the division and the players that Shamrock Rovers have, they're still the ones that stick out. But Pats, Sligo, Derry that we just mentioned there, certainly giving it a right go at the moment.
Indeed, they are. And you mentioned Dara Burns. I think he was called up to Jim Crawford's under 20 side as well, are playing the Ireland amateurs out in Home Farm as well. So hopefully it goes well for Dara, another great prospect in the league. Paul Corry, gentlemen, as always, really appreciate you taking a call. There ends our League of Ireland chat. But before we do, just to give a roundup of the First Division results as well. Cove were 3-2 winners in Athlone. Cork City won the Munster Derby 2-0 at home against Waterford. Galway were victors at home 2-1 against Treaty United, and Bray Wanderers picked up their first points of the season. They defeated Longford in Longford by 2-1. But now it is time to welcome Áine O'Gorman to the conversation, and I'm delighted to be joined by the Republic of Ireland and Piemont United footballer for the launch of this year's Aviva Soccer Sisters Easter camps. The 3-day camps open to all girls aged 6 to 14 will get underway from April 12th. Registrations for this year's Aviva Soccer Sisters Easter camps will be open at 2 p.m. on Monday, March 21st, and can be accessed via www.aviva.ie/soccer sisters. For more information and to keep up to date on this year's camps, follow Aviva Ireland on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. And breathe. Áine O'Gorman, how are you? Great to chat as always. I suppose, listen, you were at the launch of the Easter Soccer Sister Camps, and that ties in nicely with my first question about the talent that has been unearthed in the Women's National League and across the country, the young talent. We've seen the likes of Abby Larkin, and there's been so much chat of Ellen Malloy as well, and players making a breakthrough into the senior camp. But how heartening and pleasing is it to see from yourself, who's one of the more experienced campaigners in the league, to see all this young talent and to see Easter camps such as this open up and be available to unearth even more talent and encourage participation?
Yeah, Shane, look, it's brilliant. It's a great opportunity and something that probably wasn't there when I was a young girl as well, for any young girl to just get involved, go down to the camps for the first time in 2 years. They're in person, make new friends, have fun, and obviously learn new skills and grow a love for the game of football, and maybe one day follow in the footsteps of the likes of Abby Larkin and myself and play for Ireland. And Abby Larkin's an original soccer sister as well from the inaugural year, so just goes to show the impact these camps have in inspiring the next generation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mentioned there that you are, of course, a Republic of Ireland and Piemont United footballer, so it would be rude of me not to mention Piemont's amazing start to the season. Top of the table, 10 goals scored, none conceded. We talk about some of the new talents coming through, but yourself getting a brace in round one, and then Steph Roach banging them in as well. That's two doubles now in consecutive weeks. Niamh Reid-Burke as well, top of the saves chart. I mean, it's going well for you out in Piemont so far.
Yeah, look, we've gotten off to a good start after a disappointing end to last season, but I think that's motivated us going into this season, and we've obviously reflected individually and collectively on last season to better ourselves this year. But look, Shane, there's still a long, long way to go, and it's a long season ahead, so we have to continue to improve week on week, and we know the pressure will come on from the likes of Shells, Wexford's, even DLR. So look, we just have to stay on our toes and keep focusing on our own task.
Yeah, no, I think we've spoken about it in a couple of previews, and there's been a lot of commentary around it that this probably is going to be one of the most competitive women's national leagues that we've seen in quite some time, which is brilliant. You know, it's great to see kind of the positivity surrounding it and the future going forward. And I suppose we talk about the player pathways and we talk about the progression of the game. And Áine, I want to pick your brain on the recently released FAI strategic plan. So that contained several targets for the women's game to be met by the end of 2025, which included a second tier for the women's national league, a sold out Talisman Stadium hosting the FAI Cup final, a minimum of 75% attendance at a senior international matches and a peak TV audience to exceed 750,000 for national team games that are shown on TV. I mean, are these realistic targets, and how good is it to see that they are being set and we're setting goals and points that we want to meet for further progression of an already really successful game?
Yeah, look, it's great to have these targets and obviously a plan in place to reach these targets. Look, I think the support has grown for the international team, like the backing of Aviva and Sky, and I think ending off a good 2021 going into 2022, we're building momentum really well there. And obviously, if we keep getting results on the pitch, that has a knock-on effect as well. And I think the support has really helped us this year in our performance, and there's that kind of belief amongst the team that I felt has never really been there before as well. And in terms of having a second tier in the Women's National League, I would see that as a positive too, because we're seeing the fruits of having an under-17 and an under-19 league at the moment, and sometimes that step from under-19 to senior football in some clubs might be too much. So to have a second tier just kind of bridges that gap too. And look, it should always be a target to fill out a stadium for any match, the FAI Cup final in Tala, the women's international games as well. And hopefully one day we'll be having a chat about setting targets that will be in the Aviva Stadium and looking to get these sort of attendance too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely going in the right direction. I know Mark Scanlon has spoken in the past, and he spoke very well. He's represented Irish football and domestic football very well since coming on board with the FAI, and he said what we don't want to do is have an unsustainable product in the first place where semi-professionalism is there and players' wages are being paid without the actual backdrop for the clubs to be well structured. So that, I suppose, ties into the pay-for-play argument as well. And but you talk about all the positives and the supports that you feel personally. Is that tangible and you can feel it in Piemont and within the clubs in the Women's National League? Because we see Sligo entering the league this year, Athlone not too long ago, Bowes putting a big emphasis on the women's team as well. So can you feel that support there?
Yeah, definitely. And I think the FAI have backed it, and I'd have to agree with Mark on that. You have to have a good structure in place. There's no point in playing players if the environment isn't professional. And the standard of training is on professional resources off the pitch and professional, but we still have to strive, I think, for that semi-professional and one day be able to offer female players in Ireland a full-time environment. And I don't think that's going to happen in my playing career, but maybe it will when I go on to coach. But look, we're certainly stepping in the right direction, and I think it's a collaborative effort between everyone, the FAI and clubs, that we have them attainable goals moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've listened to the way you're going on, when you say not in your playing career, I'm fully expecting you still be playing in 5-10 years. Would you stop?
We'll see.
But listen, we'll come full circle and we talk about the progression of the young players coming through. I'm sure you have a sneaky eye on the trip to Sweden with the national team already. And we've mentioned the likes of Abby Larkin, Jess Sue, Ella Malloy and so on. What's impressed you most about the younger generation coming through, particularly with these young stars coming into the national team?
Yeah, I think probably just their knowledge of the game, their technical ability. Then you've got the likes of young Abby Larkin. She goes out, plays with no fear, has all the skills and the confidence and the attitude to go along with it. So, look, really, really bright future ahead and good stars. And that comes through from the likes of the emerging talent programmes that are in place now too. And I know the likes of James Scott has put a lot of effort into them as well. And it takes a few years to see for that to come to fruition.
Absolutely, but we're certainly going in the right direction. There's a lot of positivity. Anya O'Gorman, pleasure to chat as always. Thanks so much for taking the time.
No worries, Shane. Chat you down. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Anya. Right, now time to turn our attention from football to golf. And I'm delighted to say RT Sports' Greg Allen is with us live in studio. Greg, news today, Sweden's Henrik Stenson has been named Europe's Ryder Cup captain for next year's event in Rome. The 45-year-old has made 5 appearances in the tournament as a player, winning 3 times. Stenson was, of course, vice-captain under Padraig Harrington for Europe's 19-9 defeat to the United States at Whistling Straits last September. An unsurprising choice, I suppose. We were all expecting Stenson to win out.
Well, no, not really, because it was down to himself and Luke Donald. It was only last Friday that the earth began to move a little bit, and then we started to hear that Stenson and Donald were kind of not so much neck and neck, but that Stenson had edged ahead of Donald. But Luke Donald has been, like Stenson, a vice-captain before. He's a 4-time player. Stenson's a 5-time player. Donald's a former world number one, Stenson's a former major champion. So their credentials were very similar, but perhaps it's because there have been three Irish captains in the last four Ryder Cups. It might have been seen that that's a lot of Ryder Cup captains on this side of the continent, that they wanted a continent of Europe captain this time around. So Stenson was the preferred candidate in the end, but before he was named as captain, he had to relinquish really any idea of going and joining the Saudi League for the next period in which he's going to be Ryder Cup captain. So that was the critical thing which he eventually committed to. And he was one of the players who was approached, and he was coy about it, but he didn't deny that he was approached by the Saudi League. And the Saudi League hasn't gone away. Likely that there'll be events in America with gazillions of money, maybe by the end of this year. But he has to make a, he had to make a commitment to the DP World Tour that he would not be part of that for the duration of his Ryder Cup captaincy. And when he gave that, that was the determining factor we're hearing. This announcement was made in Sawgrass. He was told last Friday that if he made that commitment, he would be Ryder Cup captain, and it was announced today. But I think Luke Donald must be feeling very sore about this. A real gentleman, wasn't associated with the Saudi League, wasn't approached in the same way, certainly wasn't as big a story as Stenson being approached. But in the end, Stenson is going to be captain in 2023 and Marco Simeone in Rome, and he'll be very popular. He's an extraordinarily humorous, dry humour, very laid-back sort of guy. But he'll bring also a got a bit of fire in him when he needs. He spoke today, in fact, I think you have a clip with him, about the experience that he had as vice-captain to Padraig Harrington at Whistling Straits. And it was a losing experience, but Stenson learnt a great deal that week.
Yeah, absolutely. We can actually listen to that clip now.
I think the biggest thing now being a vice-captain at Whistling Straits was just to see it on the other side of the fence. It was of huge importance, I feel, and especially for me taking on this position. It's just seeing it from the different side. And like I said, all the captains that I've worked with and played under have done things slightly different. But we'll take with us a collaboration of what they've done and bring that on board.
Yeah, so they are the thoughts of Henrik Stenson there. So moving from the Ryder Cup to the Players' Championship, Greg, obviously we saw the winner over the weekend. And like, when you see the tournament as a whole, a lot of headlines were around, of course, that hole-in-one on the 17th for Shane Lowry. I suppose, looking at the tournament as a whole, and from an Irish point of view, because I know we're a bit pressed for time as well, Seamus Power remains in line to appear at his first Masters next month after moving up in the golf world rankings, considering his finish at the Players' Championship. And Shane Lowry has stayed in 36th after finishing in a tie for 13th at Sawgrass as well. So from an Irish perspective, how do you surmise the Players' Championship?
Well, the first thing, it was a brilliant tournament away from the Irish. You know, this is the thing that, you know, we do focus a great deal on the Irish. It's good that Seamus Power finished just outside the top 30. He had an unfortunate double bogey on 17 when he was going really well, 4 under par for the first 7 holes, I think, of his final round. And he was roaring along, then took a double on 17, put a ball in the water. And he finished well on 3 under par, and he's gained a couple of places up to 48th in the world rankings, which means that he has to stay there by the 28th of March to get into the Masters. And so it's fairly, you know, it's a narrow thing, 48th. Dropping out of the top 50. So he's got to play well over the next 2 weeks. Valspar event this week is a tight golf course. Hopefully it will suit him. Shane Lowry is playing quite well. And, you know, he's going to be stepping into the Masters, a tournament that he would so dearly love to be a challenger in. And he's played quite well around Augusta before, and then had periods when he's not played well around there. So I think he's had enough experience, Shane has, to get his head around what the Masters challenge is. And he showed that he played pretty well at the weekend, finishing tied 13th. Rory McIlroy, not so much. Great final round, but first 3 rounds, he played in some of the worst of the conditions. You know, he didn't get lucky with the conditions. The draw was hugely important in Sawgrass, and he didn't get lucky. Played well in the final round. Rory turns up next time he plays, he could be playing very, very well, because he's in that sort of mercurial mode at the moment. We don't know with Rory what's going to come out, but he's when he plays well, he plays extraordinarily well. But the overall winner, Cameron Smith, is a player to watch. He's just such a steady player. He has a mullet that harks back to the 1980s. He's got a head in him that's unique in golf, but he's got a game which is tailor-made for Augusta. He was runner-up to Dustin Johnson there in the COVID-affected 2020 Masters, and I think that Cam Smith, now number 6 in the world, is a real contender in Augusta. Look, winning the Players' Championship itself is a big, big achievement in his career, but we always think about Augusta at this time of year. And he has a game that's tailor-made to it. He plays played really well in 2020. And the way that he won yesterday, 10 birdies in the final round, so calm under pressure. And even when he put a ball in the water with a second shot on 18 yesterday, you know, to get up and down from 57 yards, almost holding his pitch for a par. A measure of the calmness. The overall golf game is good, but the head is best of all with Cam Smith. Great winner.
Absolutely. Couldn't have said it better myself. Greg Allen, thank you as always.